You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Job. Chapters 11 through 17 of the book of Job is where Pastor Sandy will be teaching today.
Verse 6. Look away from him that he may rest, till like a hired man he finishes his day. For there is hope for a tree, if it is cut down, that it will sprout again, and that its tender roots will not cease. Though its root may grow old in the earth, and its stump may die in the ground, yet at the scent of water it will bud and bring forth branches like a plant. I mean, you chop something down out in your yard, you think you finally got rid of it, and then suddenly the rains come, and oh my, it's sprouted all over again. Plants rejuvenate themselves. They shoot up again. But man dies and is laid away. I mean, once it's over for man, it's over. Indeed, he breathes his last, and where is he? As water disappears from the sea and a river becomes parched and dries up, so man lays down and does not rise. Humans only get one crack at life. Till the heavens are no more, they will not awake nor be roused from their sleep. Now, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, you don't make doctrine out of the words of a man who's got boils all over his body, scratching them with a piece of pottery, sitting in a trash heap, moaning and groaning. I mean, this is not the guy that you take his words and you turn them into doctrine. Pain has warped Job's perspective. And here's a good example. Job isn't thinking beyond the grave. He isn't even thinking of his own soul. You see, he's only concerned with his boil-racked body. And that's why he says that once he dies, his body will not awake. It won't be roused from sleep. The Bible teaches us that the body will sleep, but not the spirit. That the moment our spirit leaves this body, it retains its consciousness. It goes either to heaven or to hell. The moment your spirit, your body will sleep. It sleeps in the ground. You know, when we bury you, or when you bury me. I mean, we'll bury our body in the ground, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. Our bodies will sleep, but our spirits will leave our bodies and immediately be conscious of their new surroundings. They'll have a new environment, and it'll either be heaven or it'll be hell. Verse 13. Oh, that you would hide me in the grave, that you would conceal me until your wrath is past. I mean, think of Job. Think of the suffering. Think of the boils, the pain, the suffering he's experienced. I mean, you can understand from Job's perspective how that death would be a welcome relief. That you would appoint me a set time and remember me. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my hard service I will wait till my change comes. Now, this is interesting. Job gets a rejuvenation here of good doctrine. He does believe in a resurrection. He believes that the body will be resurrected in the future. And this is his hope, that his change will come, that he too will one day receive a body without boils. And then that's a great hope for us all, isn't it? That God will one day resurrect these bodies, that he'll give us new bodies, bodies without cancer, and bodies that don't get sick and don't become ill and don't corrupt. Incorruptible bodies, Paul calls them in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, you shall call and I will answer you. You shall desire the work of your hands. For now you number my steps, but do not watch over my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you cover my iniquity. You know, God, I wish you'd open the bag and show me what I've done wrong. But as mountain falls and crumbles away, and as a rock is moved from its place, as waters wears away stone, and as torrents wash away the soil of the earth, so you destroy the hope of man. You prevail forever against him, and he passes on. You change his countenance and send him away. Job hopes in the resurrection, but his suffering has eroded his hope like water erodes a mountainside. I mean, his pain, all his calamity has washed away his hope. Verse 21. His sons come to honor, and he does not know it. They are brought low, and he does not perceive it. But his flesh will be in pain over it, and his soul will mourn over it. In other words, we don't live long enough to see how our sons turn out. This, again, is another frustration that we have in life. Well, chapter 15 begins with the second round of these accusations. Eliphaz steps back up to the microphone. Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "Should a wise man answer with empty knowledge and fill himself with the east wind?" Now, if you look at a map, what was east of Edom? Desert. The east wind was an arid, dry, hot desert wind. And so once again, Eliphaz is accusing Job of being full of hot air. Calls him an east wind. "Should he reason with unprofitable talk or by speeches with which he can do no good? Yes, you cast off fear and restrain prayer before God." You know, it's interesting. Eliphaz accuses Job of never having prayed about his situation. Of course, that wasn't true. But what's odd is that none of Job's three friends in this whole dialogue ever bothered to stop and pray for their friend themselves. They never stop and pray for guidance. They never ask God to give them wisdom in their dealings with Job. Why do they not pray? They think they already know everything. They're know-it-alls. That's the kind of person who gives out counsel without praying. Let's not make that same mistake. "For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I. Yes, your own lips testify against you." Again, he's saying these harsh things to a man who's just buried his 10 kids. These guys are ruthless. "Are you the first man who was born? Or were you made before the heels? Who do you think you are, Job? Have you heard the counsel of God? Do you limit wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that is not in us?" And you know, these are some of the same, you recognize some of these statements because they were some of the same statements that Job made about his friends. And this is how the conversation degenerates here. I mean, what starts out as kind of being a teaching session ends up being a debate, a hostile debate. And suddenly now they're exchanging barbs. They're sort of slinging mud back and forth at each other. These are friends going at it. You know, someone once said, "Know why dogs have so many friends? They wag their tails and not their tongues." These guys are wagging their tongues. He says, "Both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, much older than your father. Are the consolations of God too small for you, and the words spoken gently with you? Why does your heart carry you away? And what do your eyes wink at that you turn your spirit against God and let such words go out of your mouth?" What is that hidden temptation that keeps pulling you away from God? Again, you know, these things don't come upon somebody unless they've sinned. Now, evidently, Job's three friends were older than Job. Eliphaz here appeals to their gray hair. You know, both the gray hair and the aged are among us. I mean, we're older than your father, Job. You need to show us some respect. I mean, we're old guys. We know more than you do. I mean, these guys were so old, they knew Dr. Pepper when he was an intern. According to Eliphaz, age equals wisdom. Age equals wisdom. Isn't that amazing? We've been married for 28 years and she still laughs at my jokes. But according to Eliphaz, age equals wisdom. But is that true? Is that always true? You ever met any dumb old men? Yeah? No offense. But yeah, that's not necessarily true. Especially when it comes to spiritual realities. You know, I've met many an elderly person who knew very little about God, who never bothered to open their Bible. Just because a man is older doesn't necessarily mean that he's wiser, especially in the ways of God. You remember in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12, Paul wrote to his young protege Timothy, and he said, "Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity." You're young, Timothy, but you're wise. Let no one despise your youth. Verse 14, "What is man that he could be pure? And he who is born of a woman, that he could be righteous. If God puts no trust in his saints, and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water?" Does that sum up anybody you know? He drinks iniquity like water. What vivid imagery there. Man's taste for sin. Now here Eliphaz refers to the saints in contrast to men. Here the word saints are the angels. You remember a third of the angels rebelled with Satan and were cast out of heaven. This defiled the heavens in God's eyes, which leads to a very provocative thought. What part of the heavens is impure? He says here, "And the heavens are not pure in his sight." What part of the heavens are not pure? I'm not sure. It is interesting in Colossians chapter 1, verse 20, that we're told that Jesus, when he died on the cross, he reconciled all things to himself. And here's what it says: "Whether things on earth or things in heaven, having made peace through the blood of his cross." But when I read that, I always get puzzled. Because what is there in heaven that needed to be reconciled? Apparently something, because here Job says that the heavens are not pure in his sight. If you have more questions about that, ask Pastor James afterwards. Verse 17. "I will tell you, hear me. What have I seen, I will declare. What wise men have told, not hiding anything received from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no alien passed among them. The wicked man writhes with pain all his days, and the number of years is hidden from the oppressor." Job, evil men suffer like you're suffering. And the rest of the chapter records Eliphaz's portrait, his portrait of a wicked person. I'm going to sum it up. A wicked man is haunted by dreadful sounds. According to Eliphaz, he's stalked by the sword. He ends up poor. He's defiant against God. Notice there in verse 27, he says that the wicked man is fat. That's what Eliphaz says. He says that his waist is heavy with fatness. So if you're a fat guy, you got to watch out for you. He dwells by himself. His life is characterized by futility and ruin. Now again, not every fat guy is wicked. Santa Claus, he's not wicked. But you know, that's the kind of insights that Eliphaz has here. He's painting in these broad brushes, and he's just making these accusations, and he's saying things that some are true, but not most of it's not true. But Eliphaz makes the point here in the end of this chapter that Job resembles the portrait of a wicked man. And this really angers Job. He's probably thinking, how low will you go to call a man evil just because he's a little chubby? And Job counters in chapter 16. Job answered and said, "I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all." What a classic line. Miserable comforters are you all. Guys, these are not the men that you appoint to make hospital calls for the church. That's not their ministry. Verse 3, "Shall words of wind have no end?" Isn't it interesting? Whenever these guys get started talking to each other, what's the first thing they accuse each other of? Being full of hot air. Being a blowhard. You know, man, you're just full of wind. Or what provokes you that you answer? I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief. Job is saying that if the roles were reversed here, he'd do a much better job of comforting them than they're doing comforting him. Though I speak, my grief is not relieved. And if I remain silent, how am I eased? But now he has worn me out. God's trial has just exhausted Job. You have made desolate all my company. You have shriveled me up, and it is a witness against me. My leanness rises up against me and bears witness to my face. I mean, Job has been worn thin. His leanness is of spirit and of courage and of faith. He tears me in his wrath and hates me. He gnashes at me with his teeth. My adversary sharpens his gaze on me. They gape at me with their mouth. They strike me reproachfully on the cheek. They gather together against me. He points to, he's sitting in the ash heap, and he points to his three friends all standing pompously around him, and he points his finger at him and says, "Why do you guys hate me? Why do you gape at me? Why are you just standing there with your mouths open? Why are you striking me on the cheek and reproaching me?" You can hear Job. He's getting riled. "God has delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over to the hands of these wicked men. I was at ease, but he has shattered me. He also has taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces." And can you imagine saying something like that about God? And here's where Job really begins to step out of line. Remember, like we talked about last week, in asking why, Job loses his way. He loses his reverence for God. "He has set me up for his target. His archers surround me. He pierces my heart and does not pity." Job is accusing God of using him as target practice. You know, in sniper school, the Marines probably use pictures of Osama bin Laden as targets. Just my guess. But Job says that God uses his picture. God uses him for target practice. Reminds me of the two Americans that went down to Mexico to open up a bungee jumping operation. They got a permit to set up this tower in the town square, and as they worked to erect the tower, a large crowd of curious locals all kind of gathered around them to watch what was going on. Finally, it came time for a test jump. One of the guys dove off of the platform, but when he bounced back up, his partner noticed that he was a little scraped. He said, "Oh, no. The cord must be too long." And so he tried to grab him, but he missed him. Well, the second time he bounced back up, he had some bruises and some broken ribs. Again, he tried to grab him, and he missed him. The third time, the guy was so badly beaten, he was nearly unconscious. This time, his sidekick kind of lunged out, and he grabbed him, and he pulled him to the platform, and he said, "Friend," he said, "Oh, my," I said, "I'm so sorry. Was the cord too long?" And that's when his partner answered, "Oh, no, the cord was fine, but what? What's a pinata?" Job feels like God has mistaken him for a pinata. That he's become God's target. That he's getting beat up. And he doesn't know why. Again, have you ever asked God why? He says, "He pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks me with wound upon wound. He runs at me like a warrior. I have sewn sackcloth over my skin and laid my head in the dust." I mean, I'm so full of mourning. I've just changed my wardrobe. I've given away all my blue jeans, and I just got sackcloth and ashes. It's what I wear every day. "My face is flushed from weeping, and on my eyelids is the shadow of death." Job had that ashen look of death that had sort of fallen upon him. Job assumes that God must hate him. Remember, though, just the opposite was true. You know, how can a man be so wrong about God? And yet many people are. "Although no violence is in my hands and my prayer is pure, O earth, do not cover my blood and let my cry have no resting place." In other words, let my cry ascend to heaven. "For surely even now my witness is in heaven and my evidence is on high." Heaven knows that Job is innocent. You know, Job knows God sees all. If I can just talk to God, if I can just appeal to the court of heaven, I know I'll be acquitted. And this is why he wants an audience with God, because heaven knows the true story. It has all the evidence. You ever listen to Handel on the Law? It's a show on WSB. Bill Handel, I think he's a kind of a deadbeat lawyer. Probably doesn't have much of a practice, and all he can do is he gives out marginal legal advice, he calls it. But you call in, you tell your story, and he tells you whether you got a case or not. That's basically what it's about. Well, Job's three counselors have been telling him he's got no case. You know, your case is flimsy. You're guilty. But Job refuses to believe them. He's so sure of his innocence. If Job can just find a lawyer who will represent him, who will get his case on heaven's docket, Job will be acquitted of all wrongdoing. He says, "My friends scorn me. My eyes pour out tears to God. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God as a man pleads for his neighbor. For when a few years are finished, I shall go the way of no return." Job maintains his claims of innocence. If he can just find a mediator, an advocate, someone licensed to practice law in heaven. You don't get that off the billboard. If he could just find a lawyer who can take his case before God, he knows he'll be judged innocent. Job needs a friend in high places. He needs a representative before God. You know, it's interesting in our legal system, when a defendant lacks an attorney, the court is obligated to hire a court-appointed attorney, a public defender, to represent the accused. And the same is true in God's courtroom, interestingly enough. Usually a public defender is either a rookie or a has-been. But in God's court, the court-appointed attorney is the best that you can hire, because Jesus has now become our advocate. He is the one who's taken our case before the bar, and we have been judged forgiven. Job says in chapter 17, "My spirit is broken, my days are extinguished, the grave is ready for me." Once again, Job has despaired of life. "Are not mockers with me? And does not my eye dwell on their provocation? Now put down a pledge for me with yourself. Who is he who will shake hands with me?" Job wants to strike a deal with anybody who can deal with God. "For you have hidden their heart from understanding, therefore you will not exalt them. He who speaks flattery to his friends, even the eyes of his children will fail. But he who has made me a byword of the people, and I have become one in whose face men spit." Can you imagine? Job has become a symbol of derision. He's become an object of mockery. People walk by the trash heap. They spit on him. They call him names. Have you noticed that at times it becomes cool to tell a certain type of joke? I mean, first there were Polak jokes. Then there were yo mama jokes. And lately there have been blonde jokes. Well, in us at the time, everybody told Job jokes. He became a byword. He says, "My eye has also grown dim because of sorrow, and all my members are like shadows. Upright men are astonished at this, and the innocent stirs himself up against the hypocrite. Yet the righteous will hold to his way, and he who has clean hands will be stronger and stronger." Job's confession: he will hold to his innocence. You know, chapter 17 is really an emotional roller coaster. Job starts out the chapter trying to strike a deal with God. He ends it in despair. In fact, why don't you read the rest of the chapter tonight? Job wonders that if he dies, if the grave becomes his home, and if the worm becomes his relative, that's how Job puts it. If he dies, he wonders, will hope die with me? In chapter 18, Bildad the Shuhite steps back up to speak another time.
Did you know that God's aware of what you're doing each day? We know this because of the book of Job. God noticed Job's life and comments to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" God was aware of Job's honor and devotion to him, and knew that Job would continue in that way no matter what happened. God has noticed you as well. Every loving gesture you make toward another human being, every moment you spend in the Bible, God sees. He does see the problems too. God knows we're drawn to sin. Even though we do our best most of the time, we all fail. God provided a solution though. He sent His Son to take our punishment for every sin we'll ever commit. We can live secure in the knowledge that if we've accepted this gift of grace, our faults no longer separate us from God. We're free to live for Him and share His incredible love and truth with the world around us. Thanks for tuning in to Sandy Adams Radio. We hope you've been encouraged by what you've heard. We'd love for you to visit our website, sandyadams.org. There you'll find more teachings by Pastor Sandy, resources to help you study the Bible, and a link to our mobile app. That's all at sandyadams.org. And that's all for today. But be sure to join us again for another edition of Sandy Adams Radio.